Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, you're very welcome to Audiovisual Cultures, the podcast that explores different areas of film, the arts and media. I'm Paula Blair, and in this episode, I talk to writer and director Leslie Goyette and producer Michelle Engelhardt about their film Maysville, which is available on various streaming sites, as well as on DVD and Blu-ray in the US. You'll find useful links in the show notes and everything else you'll need at audiovisualcultures.com. A big thank you to our patrons at patreon.com/AVcultures, whose generosity is funding our website. And thanks as well to Heather Bonnie Reed, who replied on Instagram when I posted about yet more computer woes, as it seems we have the same laptop. And Heather says, I recently discovered your podcast and it's great. I'm really glad you're enjoying it, Heather. And thank you and everyone else for listening and for engaging with us wherever you do that. So in today's discussion, we skirted around plot details for the film Maysville, but I think that it's fine for me to say that it is a tragic family and coming of age period drama set in Depression era Appalachia. If you're not aware of it, it's a rural mountainous area in the United States. Leslie and Michelle take us through quite a lot of the production details, including, importantly, their experience with crowdfunding and simply asking for things. They told people what they needed and they made a film that looks a lot more expensive than it is because of the kindness of the communities they were working with. And I think that's really pertinent for me because as living in Newcastle upon Tyne has taught me, shy bairns getting out. You know, if you don't ask, you don't get. Leslie and Michelle really show why it's important to just go for it, to just tell people, look, this is what we need to do this. What do you think? What can you do? We do mention some difficult topics around death, poverty, and abusive behaviour, but there's also a lot of joy and hope that restores some faith in humanity in both the story of Maysville and the story of making Maysville the movie. So I really hope you enjoy this one. It was just a really great conversation and it was a real joy to meet Leslie and Michelle as well. They're welcome back anytime. So I hope you get a lot out of it. I know I certainly did. Leslie Goyette and Michelle Engelhardt, thank you so much for joining me on Audiovisual Cultures. We're going to discuss your independent film, Maysville. That's just so exciting. But just first of all, if it's okay, could I ask each of you to introduce yourselves a bit and to explain the roles each of you had in the film? If we start with Leslie, is that all right? And then we'll move to Michelle.
Sure. My name's Leslie Goyette. I was the writer and one of the producers and the director for the film. My amazing partner, Michelle. Go ahead, Michelle.
So, yes, my name is Michelle Engelhardt. I am a producer on Maysville. So Leslie and I teamed up to get the film made.
I know that getting the film made at all was a huge achievement for both of you. So we'll try and learn a bit about that in a moment. But where did the story come from and why did you decide to tell it on film? We'll talk about the story itself in a bit, but I just wondered what were the origins of the story, first of all?
Well, the origins of the story, it's a coming of age story set in the 1920s in a part of the United States called Appalachia. Appalachia is a remote part of the United States. It's a very mountainous area. It's part of where I grew up. So that part of the country, it's a poverty-stricken area. And I kind of wanted to tell a story about things that I had seen and things that I had witnessed and growing up in that area. But I also wanted to take it back in time a little bit. Some of the characters are kind of very loosely based on people that I had interacted with throughout my life. Teddy and Willie, the two main characters early on in the film, are based on my sister and my relationship, the closeness that we had. the adventures that they have together, things like that. Those are all things that I did as a child with my sister. It's not by any means autobiographical. Goodness, it's not autobiographical. It's based on, you know, the area where I grew up with. And that's where it kind of came from.
And why it's told on film was the second part of your question. And Leslie can answer this better than me. But I just want to say, as a writer, Leslie is a very visual writer. And when I first read the script, I could picture every scene in my mind, like how it was going to be. And she's not a prolific writer. It's very, you know, not a lot of information, but the right amount of information for me to visualize, really picture how this would be filmed, which I thought was unusual because I do read a lot of scripts. I think she's just a visual writer, which lends itself to film.
And then is that what really attracted you to producing it then, Michelle? Was just you wanted to visualize that for Leslie?
So we'll tell you the backstory.
Please do.
Because Leslie and I, we knew each other. We had met on a set that our kids had done a commercial for probably 8 years ago now, a while ago, and kept in touch via, you know, social media, Facebook. She lives in Portland, which is about 3 hours from where I'm at in Seattle. So just, you know, acquaintances over social media. But one day she pinged me and asked if I'd be, she had watched a short film that I had put out on social media that my son had been in, and she watched it and thought he would be perfect for the role of Willie for this script she wrote. I didn't know she was a writer, and she had never previously shown anybody her scripts. So she's kind of like a closet writer, she says. So she sent me the script. And I started reading it, and I'm not sure if you had time to watch the film, but the setup of the film is with the boys, you know, they're tweens. The first 15 minutes of the film, you watch the setup, and I read up to that point in the script, and I was just like, oh my God, this is one of the best scripts I've read. And I could just, my heart, I was totally engaged by page 10, you know, just sucked in. And by like 16 or something, I texted her. I said, oh my God. And she said, oh my God, good, or oh my God, bad, because I was the first person to have read the script. And I said, oh my God, I just called her. And I said, this is so good. This is just so good. So that's how I got sucked in. I didn't know, maybe at that time that it was her first script. I didn't know anything, you know, if she had made any short films or anything. She came up to Seattle and we did a table read. And then after the table read, she said, so I don't know if this can just be a short film or if we could do a feature length film, but you know, we're two ladies. We can get it done. Could you help me? I've never done a film before. So I don't know. I tell people I don't usually believe in fate, but I feel like there's an element here of why this all came together. Why I said yes. I thought it was just crazy. I'm more conservative than Leslie and, you know, don't usually take risks like this. And it was the right time in my life. And we kind of just figured it out together over the last 3.5 years. It's been kind of a crazy ride. We've learned a ton. And I think we produced something pretty good for, you know, given what we, the resources that we had at play.
Fantastic. And Leslie, do you want to add anything to Michelle's story there?
Well, yeah, I've been I call myself a closet writer for many years. I have so many scripts and short stories and so on. And I write, but I've always felt that sharing your writing is like letting someone see you make it, you know, nobody. You know, you just don't want to do that. And because it shows all your flaws, it shows, you know, your inhibitions, it shows everything in your writing, and people can really judge you on your writing. So even though I love to write, I've never really shared my writing with anyone. So it was a big step for me to say, hey, I'm going to share something with you. And it was easier to share it with someone that I didn't know really well than it was to share with someone who I intimately know or care a lot about, because Michelle could have been honest with me. Does that make sense? Michelle had nothing vested. She could have hurt my feelings and said, well, thank you, but I don't think this is something for us right now. But her response was authentic and genuine, and she was very enthusiastic about the script. So that made me feel somewhat validated. I guess all writers maybe need some kind of validation before they take the next step. At least for me, it did.
That's a really important story to tell, I think, because there's probably a lot of people out there like you who are sitting on work and they're too scared to share it with anyone. And that's a really great story of where it can actually work out if you take that leap into the abyss. So that's really great for people to hear, I hope.
Yeah, I hope so. Art is the most important thing to me, art's the most important thing in the world because it brings joy, right? Whatever form of art there is, it brings joy. And it sometimes being afraid to share your art keeps people from sharing it, you know, and it may really resonate with someone.
How then did you go from the idea and the script to actually getting it into production? Because I know that you went down the crowdfunding route. I'm sure there's a big story behind that as well.
I think one of the smart moves we made is we carved out 6 months to see how much money we could raise, to see whether we could take on a feature length film funding wise, or whether we just might have enough money to do what we'd feel be to put forward a short film. I think a lot of filmmakers, at least a lot of local indie filmmakers I know, they don't necessarily take that time. They kind of wing it and try to do stuff on no money. And I do think we did the right thing by taking that time and doing it. And it didn't just raise the funds. It helped spur our marketing right from the very beginning. To start building your audience early is some advice we got from another producer that I think was well taken. So the two can go hand in hand. We did what we thought was a big crowdfunding on Indiegogo, which was quite successful. We more than made our goal, and that inspired us to think that we had enough to make a feature film, which we actually ended up doing. We had to do a lot of asking because we didn't have enough money to make a really good quality feature film. The film is set back in the 1920s. So that's another feat that's quite hard to pull off as an indie filmmaker, to make it authentic looking to the 1920s, and more expensive, right? With all the props and setting locations and all that. So in addition to, you know, raising the money, we had to do a lot of asking of, hey, can you volunteer to let us use your vintage car? Yeah, we asked the towns. We found two historic towns next to each other for filming. You know, we had to ask, you know, their city council if we could use their public spaces. They gave it to us for free. Just about all the locations were given to us for free to use. The props, antiques, even an old tractor, the perfect old tractor we were looking for that actually looked new. We found a steam train. There's a local steam train that actually still operates down there, and we needed one for the film. They gave us the use of that for free. I mean, it was just almost ridiculous how much was just given to us just because we asked. So the combination of raising what we thought was enough money in conjunction with just getting out there and asking people. People are excited to make a film. This was in two towns that are pretty, not remote, but there's not a lot going on down there. And they are historic. And I think that a lot of people in those towns thought it was really cool that a film set back in the 20s was going to be made in their town. So there's a lot of get up and go, a lot of goodwill down there that we found. And we also did a dinner fundraiser down there to raise money. That was the initial reason, but it actually did a lot more than that. It got that goodwill. It got the word out and the excitement out. A lot of the people down there became extras in the film. They're really excited about that. And some of them brought their own wardrobes and just got really into it.
Even the fire chief, the chief at the fire station helped us. We didn't have $1,600 to rent a rain machine. So he brought the fire truck and hooked up the hose, and we got one take. We got one shot on this one take, and he just sprayed the hose in the air and got the rain to come down on the actors, and it worked. We were so excited. We had shot the scene twice already with no rain. We're like, well, if it doesn't work, we'll have our backup, right? Yeah, so and it was amazing just to see a community come together to try to make this project, because when we were at the dinner, we just had a captive audience. We asked people, we're like, this is what we need. 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 And by the time we were done with that dinner, we had two people volunteer their barns to be burned down. And we were just asking kind of, you know, oh, by the way, we need to burn down a barn. Does anyone have a barn we can burn down? We got two volunteers.
Yeah, we were just kind of jokingly asking too.
Wow.
The thing that we learned in all of this is that at the end of the day, people want to help people. They do. It's just a lot of times people don't want to ask for help. So our motto became the power of the ask. Be authentic in your ask. Be truthful. Be honest. Let them know this is where I'm coming from. I don't have a budget where I can, you know, give you money. But the people were just so wonderful and excited to be, you know, a part of it.
And to be part of something creative that's bigger than yourself. I think that I would sign on if somebody asked me, you know. Anyway, it's exciting to be part of something that so many people are involved in to actually put something on the big screen that could look really good. They didn't know us. They didn't know. We have no stars in the film, you know, no A-listers that are recognizable on a marquee. But they totally bought into the story and the idea of making a film down there. And the fact that it was set back in time, I think it was another big selling point.
Okay. Oh, that's such a fantastic story. I just feel like there's the whole other side of this film as well. It's got a really beautiful story that it can circulate with. So I think then to get into more details about the film itself, you know, as indicated very clearly by the title, the location is so important. And as you're saying, it's that community. And it's great to hear such a positive story around the making of the film, because I think the film itself deals with really very difficult issues and not so much of a community spirit going on, if I'm picking up on that right. So I was just wondering if you could help flesh out a bit more for any listeners, especially here in the UK. You know, we're fed a lot of culture from the US, but the specific location and at that time that you're talking about, most of us are going to know absolutely nothing about that. So if it's okay, could you just help flesh that out a bit more for us? So Depression era, a very rural, very mountainous area, and then the sorts of issues that you're dealing with that, because, you know, there's going to be a lot bubbling around that as well, in terms of, because I think the suffrage movement was going on, and then there's a lot of racial problems, and then there's class issues as well that you've mentioned. So if you're happy to, maybe Leslie, could you just flesh that out a bit more, because that's your story as well that you're wanting to tell.
Well, if we're going to talk about Appalachia, I do need to make sure that I preface that these are my people. This is where I grew up, and I love and adore where I'm from. So by any means, the purpose of this is not to shine a negative light on the people of Appalachia. But Appalachia in the 1920s is very different from Appalachia nowadays. We're going back in time, and we're looking at a time when I don't think things were so different so much in Appalachia as they were in other parts of the country. Women were more of a second-class citizen than men, even in the early 1920s. Women were discarded a little bit more. We were dealing with, I don't want to give away too much of the story, because there is a very big twist at the end. And the big twist at the end actually will explain the actions by a lot of the characters throughout. But infidelity is one of the most sinful things that you could have done in that time period in Appalachia. It's something that was a scarlet letter. You know what I'm saying? Very much of a scarlet letter. The area itself is, like I said, it's underserved, but there's not a lot of wealth. Generations after generations after generations live there. So not a lot of people, a lot of families can break out a poverty cycle. But at the same time, they're also a very strong, faithful community. They're very strong in their faith and their beliefs. So trying to explain that without giving away too much of the story, that's a little bit of a fine line to walk there, but it's a very beautiful part of the country, the Appalachian Trail. A lot of people will hike that, and it's just a mountainous trail on the eastern part of the United States. It's beautiful, and the people are wonderful. They're just very set in their ways, and sometimes people will justify their action by what has happened to them. And I hate to use the old terms, but an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. A lot of times people still feel that way. And back in that time, the 1920s, there was not law enforcement as you would see it now, right? There was one local sheriff for like three or four towns. And that was the case in the story of Maysville. We had one sheriff that kind of took care of many different areas and things like that. So I hope that kind of helps kind of describe a little bit more of it.
And Leslie, you know, she mentioned some of this, a lot of it is pulled from her childhood here and there, which Leslie and I are about the same age. So grew up in the 70s. It's set back in the 1920s because maybe it's a little bit more believable that some of these things actually can happen. They still actually, Leslie, maybe you could talk to this, can happen today. That people, some of the things that happened in the movie, you're like, that could never happen. Well, Leslie might know situations in her childhood where things like that actually did happen.
Yeah. I grew up in this. We were poor. We were poorer growing up. We didn't have a car. I don't think anyone would ever relate to that. You know what I'm saying? The 70s, 80s, and 90s. Growing up, how did you not have a car? But we didn't have a car. We didn't have a telephone. That sounds crazy. When I was in high school, we did not have a telephone because we couldn't afford it. And having that, you know, even though some of the things that you see, you know, was in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, I took it back to the 20s because I just don't think that if I told a story in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, people nowadays would not believe that. People would not believe that. How does a family not have a telephone? How do you not have a landline in your house? Well, we didn't. I had a single mother with trying to raise three children on her own. And it was just the circumstances that we grew up in. So I decided to take this story back to the 20s to make some of the things, you know, that I can relate to from my childhood. It would explain things a lot easier.
That's really great to hear about that, Leslie, because that was something I was going to ask you about, because the setting is almost 100 years on from where we are today. I think that actually quite a few of the issues that come up in the film are really prescient right now. I think especially with a lot of what we've seen with abusive behaviour and race relations and gender inequality and everything, even well into the 21st century now. So I think it is a very 2020 story in a lot of ways, as much as it is a 1920 story. So it's really great to hear. And really fascinating what you're saying as well about that decision to go back to the 20s. That makes a lot of sense, actually, because I grew up more in the 80s in the UK. And yeah, it would, even for a lot of us who would be considered poor or underprivileged, well, we probably would have had access to a landline telephone or a car of some description, even a neighbour's car or something like that. So, you know, that's really just fascinating context to hear about that. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Yeah, you just hit the nail on the head. You really did. You really summed that up very well. It's just interesting. You know, even when I was telling Michelle some of the stories from my childhood, Michelle's like, what? What? Because, you know, growing up at the same time, and regionally, we were just a few hundred miles from each other. She was growing up in Illinois and I was growing up in Kentucky. But we grew up in two very different worlds. Very, very different worlds. And it's just fascinating just to see that how two people who were completely different, not far from each other, but just experienced two drastically different childhoods.
You mentioned earlier as well that the two boys, Teddy and Willie, they're based very roughly on you and your sister. And then putting it back to the 20s and changing them to boys, is that just again to facilitate the storytelling? Do you think it's easier if they're boys or?
It was easier for me because there were some parts that I didn't want to share about my life.
Okay.
I just felt that it was the right thing to do was to make them boys. Some of the things that my sister and I did were very boy roles. You know, we would climb in the barns and climb, you know, 50 feet into the rafters. I would die now if I saw my kids doing things like that. You know, we would go frog gigging and, you know, we would shoot guns. We shot guns in the fields. You know, a lot of the things that you see Teddy and Willie doing, they're definitely more masculine things. But those were the things that we had to do. That's what we had to play with when you're very removed from city folk. So that's just what we had to do. Things that were around a farm area, that's what we had to play with. And that's what we did. There was a lot of times when I was very, you know, emotional on set, you know. I just think that if it would have been two little girls, I would have been just a total mess, you know, because I'm so close with my sister and I love her so much. So I think having the boys, it kind of kept things a little bit more controllable for me.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's really useful to hear. I mean, we talked earlier as well about just how positive the production experience was. And it does look like you, although maybe we wouldn't consider a lot of the actors as terribly famous or anything like that, they're actually really high caliber in the performances that you've got out of them. And you've got really high production value in how the film has been filmed, the lighting, the music, and all of these elements that make it look very polished, and they make it look a lot more expensive than it probably actually was, which is a real achievement. Yeah.
Thank you, Paula. Coming from you, that really means a lot. Someone who has so much education and someone who has spent so much time studying film. That's really sweet of you to say. That means a lot. But we were limited with our actors. We were limited with what we had to choose from and what we had to work with. But I do agree with you. I do think that we got some really, really genuine performances. And I think that it came through. They were more than just characters. They really worked really hard to get to where they needed to be. And some of the scenes were hard. Some of the scenes were very hard. But I think they rose to the occasion. I do. And we wanted to make a film. And when I talked to Michelle about this, I did not want to tell this story how a modern day director would tell a story. Stories nowadays are very different, are told very different than how they were told when I was a kid. When my children watch films from my childhood, and I'm like, oh, this is Stand By Me, you're going to love it. Rob Reiner is great, blah, blah, blah. This is Ron Howard, and this is Joe Dante. When I share with them, they think, oh, these look old. These look really old. And they're very much a narrative film, right? Whereas a more modern day film, a lot of modern day stories are told with inner dialogue of the characters. We mostly see reactions and we feel, and the audience is trying to see what is going through the mind of the characters. And it's not so spoon fed to the audience. So Michelle and I, we wanted to tell an old fashioned story, not necessarily old fashioned, but we wanted to tell it the way that we grew up watching movies. And that was the intent. So if you'll listen to the score is very much something you would have heard in the 80s and 90s. Someone brought up Out of Africa. It has a score from like Out of Africa or something like that. It has more of an epic sound to it than something that is a little bit more modern. And that was the look and the feel that we were going for from day one with our cinematographer and our composer.
The film is getting really positive reviews wherever people are watching it. So could you point listeners towards where they can find it and any information as well out there that they can find about it? Maybe Michelle, would you like to?
Yeah, so it's on Amazon and it's on Tubi TV and it's on Google Play and YouTube. It's also being taken to the Cannes film market coming up. So excited to see if it hopefully can go somewhere via that avenue. And yeah, we're on Facebook. Maysville the Movie on Facebook is probably the best place to go on social media to find out the latest, what's going on with our film and the reviews. We post them there. Just all the press, everything is on our Facebook page. Did I miss anything, Leslie?
I don't think so.
Fantastic. Do either of you have anything you really want to add about the film? Because we've been tiptoeing around the story because we don't want to give too much away. But is there anything else you want to add about your experience in making it and the people that you worked with? Anything at all?
Well, I think we kind of already said it, but just to reiterate the craziness of how, I mean, you mentioned the production value of the film and the good acting and all around. I think we really made a really solid looking film. That's the feedback we get, that it looks studio quality. If you knew our budget was less than US dollars. You know, we say for the price of a new car, we made this film over the course of 3 years. And I'm biased, but I think it looks and feels and watches, it's amazing for what we spent. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we're first-time filmmakers. We've never even made a short film before. And we did this and pulled it off. And so I think that's the story behind the story. Feedback just in general is that it's a really good story and beautifully told. And we just hope that people will watch it.
And Leslie, I hope this gives you the confidence to get more of those scripts out of that closet. Yeah.
I hope so. I hope to find that one person out there that would believe in me. We've been told, do not tell anyone what you spent on this film. Don't keep that budget keep it quiet, because if anyone knew what we really did here with the amount of money that we had, they would know that it was just shy of a miracle. But there's a part of me that says, look what I can do for this amount of money. If you would just believe in me, I could do an amazing product with a few $100,000, you know. I don't even need, you know, millions of dollars. I don't need that. And I don't think a lot of people need that to bring a quality piece of work to film. I don't. There was a film that came out this year called Math. I don't know if you have heard of that or saw it, but it was just four actors in a room. That's it. And four incredible actors. And the film was done for $300,000. It just goes to prove that sometimes you can just have a good story And if you have good performances, then just believe in someone, you know, just believe in that director that they can deliver something. I would love to be able to find someone who would believe in Michelle and I, because we have so many stories that we could share. They're very different from Maysville. Very different. Where I'm definitely more of a, I like Stephen King, not necessarily horror, but I love thriller. I love to get people thinking. And I have four other scripts that I would love to hopefully someday do this crazy thing again.
I think that's a fantastic message to finish on. I absolutely hear you. I just totally agree with everything that you're saying. Give people chances, give people resources, and look what they can achieve. So that's such an important message for this. And I just feel so privileged that you've both come on and talked about all of this and shared your story. And I hope that my tiny podcast can in some small way get that message out there as well for you. So Leslie Goyette and Michelle Engelhardt, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and just wish you all the best with everything that is to come. And I hope there are great things coming for you. And I really hope I get to speak to you again at more length another time.
Yeah, me too.
Well, thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you so much, Paula. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. Thank you for tuning in to this Cozy Pea Pod production. If you got something out of this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good rating wherever you're accessing it and share it with someone you know will find it really interesting. If early releases and bonus content sound appealing, visit patreon.com/AVcultures and join one of our support tiers. If you want to help the show but can't manage a membership, we'd love you to join the conversation with AV Cultures Pod on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. The music is Common Ground by Airtone, used under a 3.0 Creative Commons non-commercial license, and is available at ccmixter.org. I've been Paula Blair, and you've been a fantastic audience. Mind yourselves, until next time.